Welcome to Healthcare by the Numbers, a podcast that uncovers what's driving healthcare transformation. Join us each episode as Caravan Health leaders interview the brightest minds inspiring healthcare innovation and discuss the numbers which have shaped their thinking.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Louise Yanug, Senior Policy Analyst at Caravan Health, and this is Healthcare by the Numbers, a podcast that explores the numbers driving change throughout our industry. To learn more about Caravan Health, this podcast, and to check out episodes of the show, visit caravanhealth.com. And be sure to sign up for our newsletter to be notified of future episodes. You can also visit our program page on Healthcare Now Radio and follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook under our username at Caravan Health. Today, I am pleased to be talking to one of our Caravan Health leaders, Miguel Brumont, our Chief of Staff. Miguel will share his experience in healthcare, observations about healthcare delivery, and his experience transitioning from a large healthcare system to a rural safety net company here at Caravan. Welcome to the podcast, Miguel.
Thanks, Louise. It's great to be here and appreciate the invitation. I love the theme of the podcast, the work you guys do here, and I'm honored to be able to contribute to the conversation we're having today. So thanks for having me.
We're very happy to have the opportunity to talk to you. At Caravan, as you know, we guide our partners in their journey transitioning to value-based care. Miguel serves as our first company chief of staff. He came on board with us in 2019, and today we welcome him to the podcast to hear more about the important work that he does. Miguel, for those who don't know you yet, what should our listeners know about you and your work?
Thanks, Louise. Good question. I've been working in healthcare throughout most of my adult life. My first job in healthcare was actually as a unit clerk at an academic medical center in the Bronx of New York. And to this day, interestingly, I think of it as one of the most difficult roles of my career. I was in a float pool, and so I essentially just come to work and be assigned to work on a random unit, where I'd have to collaborate with a different care team of physicians, nurses, care management, environmental services, runs the gamut of the whole care team. And I thought at that time it was a very serious job for an 18-year-old, but it's one that really, you know, shaped my path and interest in healthcare and my approach towards healthcare for the things that I saw throughout my period there. I was originally very interested in becoming a physician, and combining that with policy and advocacy work and to lead change across the health system. But through that experience, throughout my college years of working as a unit clerk, I saw many things that could not necessarily be changed for the expertise of a clinician or a prescription or a surgery, and wanted to impact that area. And so explored a degree in public health. And, you know, I've worked at Caravan for 2 years in the chief of staff role, got my MPH in health policy and management. And I've worked in several roles in the New York Presbyterian Health Enterprise and strategy development across population health and medical group management. It's been a very rewarding journey to date, and it's been excited to be at Caravan to contribute to the work that's done across the nation.
Thanks, Miguel. In each of our shows, we like to spotlight and frame our conversation with some of the facts and figures impacting our industry today. You really have a unique role at Caravan. The chief of staff has a role in all parts of the company and has a finger on the pulse of all of our departments. I thought we would kick off today's conversation with a few of the numbers facing value-based payment in terms of the overall industry and direction about the future. As we get into this new year, there really is a lot to talk about. So we're coming up on the 12-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act and the 10-year anniversary of the earliest accountable care organizations. The CMS Innovation Center during that time has launched more than 50 alternative payment models to reward high quality and cost-efficient care. They're running 28 models currently. It's a whole lot of work. CMS has expressed the goal of streamlining the number of models to focus on what works, make health equity a centerpiece of model design, and give providers the tools they need to manage and to manage risk and sustainably transform care. I think this context is important to understand, and CMS really is looking back over what's happened over the past 10 and 12 years to figure out a path forward. CMS has committed to having all Medicare lives and most Medicaid lives into accountable care and similar arrangements, similar total cost of care arrangements by 2030. We're clearly looking at sort of the next chapter of value-based care, and Caravan Health is going to play an important role there. So those are the numbers. It's clear that there are plans in the future to enhance and expand value-based payment. Miguel, I'm curious what numbers jump out to you most.
Yeah, it feels both, I have to say, distant and like yesterday at the same time since the Affordable Care Act has passed. You know, I interned at the New York State Health Insurance Department on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in graduate school, and I still remember my jubilance at the opportunity to firsthand be a part of major healthcare reform. You know, I'd start by saying there's been a lot of meaningful work that's been accomplished or is in progress. It's certainly starting with the write-in and passing of the legislation, design and develop and launch in, maintaining and analyzing the impact of all of these payment models is a Herculean task. And I can only imagine the scale of doing that for 50 different advanced payment models is just incredible. So kudos to the CMS teams and the work they've done there. And, you know, on the provider and health system side, I'd say implementing a payment model, it requires a lot of dedication, but with the right tools and strategy, it can be very rewarding, and the outcomes for patients, care teams, the healthcare institutions and society at a large is very beneficial. You know, ACOs have been very successful payment models. As many as 11 million Medicare beneficiaries were attributed to an ACO in 2021. Our clients at Caravan achieved as much as 160 million in savings and $60 million in shared savings over 2020 to 2021. The model works. The numbers I think that stand out are similar to the ones that many of the, you know, health experts and policymakers are thinking about across the country. And it starts with the healthcare costs, which really remains unmanageable. There's also a lot of talk about, you know, retirement and the Social Security Trust Fund, and folks are thinking about, you know, how they retire and whether that will be a part of their retirement package or not. But, you know, going back to the cost of healthcare, you know, national health costs grew by 9.7% to $4.1 trillion in 2020. Medicare spending grew by 3.5%, that's $830 billion in 2020. And Medicaid spending also grew by 9.2%. And so projected, I think, for 2019 to 2028, the, you know, health cost is expected to reach $6.2 trillion in 2028. So either way you look at it, it's a focus that CMS needs to have because it just makes sense. Whether, you know, I think there will be resource constraints as it stands. And we know that there's variation in outcomes for the care that's provided, and there are opportunities to improve. And so when I think about these numbers, I think CMS has the right approach, and it's just about getting the models right and ensuring that all of the relevant stakeholders, from our patients, caregivers, and society at large, benefits from the work that's done there. Some of the other figures I think that really stand out and have probably been exacerbated by the pandemic, I think about social determinants of health and, you know, homelessness, having safe housing, food insecurity, you know, air and water quality and pollution. I think these are certainly things that haven't necessarily found a home. There has been a lot of discussions about who is responsible for the overall strategy towards improvement within the health system in these areas. And some health systems have taken novel approaches and, you know, offering housing or finding creative ways to improve social determinants. But these are systems that generally have, I think, the financial resources to do well in, to influence these areas more rapidly than the smaller institutions may. But you know, all to say, I think it's hard to imagine that a patient who has high blood pressure or diabetes, but at the same time experiences food insecurity or homelessness, will be able to adhere to their medication regimen or to even remember to purchase the medication. So these things play a huge part in the outcomes of our patients, and I think it's important that we continue to put an emphasis on the impact, the numbers there, and how we can impact patients' lives in these areas as well.
Thank you. You just mentioned so many of the important things that we're facing coming up this year, as well as for the next who knows how many years, in terms of rising healthcare costs, social determinants of health. And one thing that we can't avoid talking about, and we don't want to avoid talking about, are the effects of the COVID pandemic on all of these providers that are working so hard to care for communities. And in talking with a lot of our clients and our partners who are part of our accountable care organizations, they repeatedly talk about how the tools they learn as part of an ACO helped them, especially early on in the pandemic, to provide care to their communities and to stay in touch with the people. They knew very well exactly what their patient populations needed. They knew how to reach them. They had care management programs in place that were fairly well matured because of their ACO work. And so knowing how much help a solid population health program can be in addressing, as we keep saying, the unexpected, unprecedented times of a pandemic is just really encouraging. And so we're very glad to hear your thoughts about that. You had talked a little bit about your sort of first job in healthcare, which I found very interesting to hear about. How did you make the decision to go into public health? How did you decide on this as a career? I mean, you talked about some of the other options that you considered.
I grew up in the Caribbean. I grew up in the Caribbean in a small island called Dominica. It's about 290 square miles and a population of about 72,000 people. And as I mentioned earlier, my dream job as a child was, to be a physician. I was moved by the idea of serving society by healing. And I took the opportunity to volunteer and to embed myself in different activities that allowed me to know more about what it meant to be a physician, just given the time commitment and education and training, et cetera. But throughout that period, I saw a lot of, systemic issues. I worked with Medicare beneficiaries who needed advocacy, as an example, and many of them were choosing between, buying groceries and prescription drugs. And this was prior to the donut hole being fixed. I saw a lot of, volunteering and serving meals for folks who were food insecure. I learned a lot about their stories and how easy it was to fall from, the security of having a job to being one paycheck away from having a home. And so I think ultimately I was driven by a curiosity to better understand the healthcare system in the US, an interest in addressing the challenges around cost and access and quality. I thought public health was a really great way to have a large impact, and certainly explored it, and it was the perfect fit.
Absolutely. For those of our listeners who may not have worked on Medicare Part D back in the day, the donut hole was the coverage gap. After the initial coverage period, there was a gap that was usually more than $1,000, as I recall, before coverage would kick in again. It was a unique construction of health benefits, and I understand that the Affordable Care Act mostly did away with that. So it's mostly a relic at this point, but it certainly is something that brings me back to my Part D launch days when I was a Medicare analyst back in the day. So we are very lucky to have gotten you at Caravan. What was it that drew you to Caravan Health, Miguel?
Yeah, well, it's been a great 2 years. And I think in reflection, it, you know, at that point and now, it was an easy decision and one that I've appreciated over time. I think it starts with the mission. I think on a personal level and with the company, we were aligned on having a meaningful impact. But also, I think the areas of impact was important too. Specifically, the emphasis that Caravan placed on rural health was key. Throughout the interview stage, I met some really amazing and brilliant folks who spoke with passion and had a deep level of expertise. And I saw the potential to collaborate, but also to learn and grow as well. And programmatically, you know, this is a company that's at the forefront, I think, of innovation and continues to grow and change for the better. And I would say lastly, you know, I think maybe not just lastly, but collectively, I was drawn to the culture. You know, I look forward to coming to work here. And I think, you know, I looked at the numbers and saw some figures from Gallup that said as much as, you know, 48% of people are completely satisfied with their jobs and 39% are somewhat satisfied. And, you know, you can sort of tease through that data, but in my own personal opinion, it's not a healthy statistic. So I appreciate on a personal level, you know, having the opportunity to make a difference on a national stage, but also to be fulfilled with my work environment and the work that I do as well.
So the chief of staff, of course, was a new role for the company back in 2019 when you were when you came into the job. I'm curious how you, if you can tell us a little bit about how your role helps run the company, but also about how you were able to sort of define that space as chief of staff for a company that hadn't had one before, and a company which, as you say, is generally, folks are very happy to be working here, of course, but it has been growing and changing in its product offerings for a variety of reasons. And it's a job where I imagine no 2 days are the same. So I'm just curious what that was like, getting into that role and sort of figuring out how to define that space.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I've been lucky to have throughout my career a lot of managers who have challenged me by introducing me to unknown spaces and given me the freedom to figure it out. And throughout my time at New York Presbyterian Hospital, there are, you know, many new initiatives, programs, and projects that we work through. It runs the gamut from, you know, how do we address the opioid epidemic, precision medicine, but on a larger scale, more complex projects like our population health strategy, defining that. And we were able to, at that point, had a lot of disparate programs that were functioning well, but weren't cohesive under one umbrella. And so as an example, you know, building the infrastructure that was truly supported population health, as an example, was one of the areas of focus that I worked on, and did the same with our medical groups back when I was there. Again, the focus of transforming independent practices into a high performing system. And so I think the experience there of always, you know, doing things that were unknown and exploring that has certainly been a good guide towards developing the right temperament and personality for the role. It's like you say, you know, 2 days are the same, the projects and scope and challenges changes from day to day. And that certainly is a space that I enjoy being in. I will say though, the work isn't necessarily, I think it's just collectively our work, and it's difficult to be successful outside of a culture that doesn't embrace teamwork. And so, you know, I think I'm one part of a remarkable group of people, and we're able to collectively work together to succeed. So,
do you have a favorite part of your job as chief of staff?
It's a good question. Yeah, I think, again, it really, I would say, comes down to just No 2 days are the same, as I mentioned. And I think it there's the absence of monotony, so that's always appreciated. But also the people that I work with, I think they make work fun. It's hard and it's challenging. I think those are two areas I'd probably call out.
So I want to get back to policy. Every conversation with me does get back to policy, something you probably know about me pretty well. And I know you follow ACO and Medicare policy closely, just because it's part of your training too. If you had what I call a policy magic wand, you know, making any changes that you could possibly think of, what changes would you make over the next couple of years to advance value-based payment?
Two things that really stand out to me would be around technology. I think throughout the pandemic, we've done a lot to improve access through telehealth to the virtual care, et cetera. And I think it, you know, a lot of the challenges around a lot of the challenges in many health systems face are related to technology constraints. And we could think solely of telehealth, but you know, when you are looking to implement a new program or a new system, technology and its cost come into the evaluation quickly. And so, you know, I think if there was some change we could create, and I'm being intentionally broad here, but to ease the constraints that providers face with technology, whether it's access to telehealth, access to broadband, internet, EHR, and any of these other things that help to make systems run more smoothly and to improve access to care for patients would be a huge add-on, and making it in some ways more affordable. And I know that some work has been done there, but clearly, there's more that can be done. And so a nudge in that direction might be helpful. And we've already talked about it, but social determinants of health is obviously plays a key part. And so working to address, you know, some area of that, whether it's how it's measured, what the appropriate incentives would be for creating change, and who's responsible ultimately for whether it doesn't necessarily have to be one party, but who's responsible for enacting change in that area? Because I think it's still an open question as to whether it's health systems, the individual, or other programmatic areas that might be supported by federal or state funding.
I couldn't agree more. And I wonder if a lot of the, if a big change could be made by just making efforts to decrease uncertainty for providers. Things like, even like the extension of the public health emergency for COVID. It, you know, it comes up every 90 days and it's, I mean, I think we're, you know, there's a big question about how long this will last, and that gets into very important flexibilities that providers and patients have come to rely on. Things like telehealth, cost share waiving, that sort of thing, that would be a really big deal if they did go away. And there should, I believe that if you were able to give more certainty to providers about, even about physician pay, something that it comes up at the end of just about every year for Congress to address, you could dedicate more time to solving those really stubborn issues around social determinants of health and getting patients really what they need. So I guess I've answered my own magic wand question there, which may not be so very helpful, but there you go.
I'll just say that that's a great point. I mean, certainly it helps with your short-term and your long-term plan. And if you can, you know, think through, if you're aware of what changes are to come and thoughtfully plan for it. So I think you're spot on there.
Sure. When you're talking about a 90-day window for a public health emergency, you may be scheduling patients more than 90 days out, depending on what's going on, and to be able to know what is even possible, or, you know, what will the patient pay at that point is, I just think would add a tremendous amount of stability to the system. Again, this is a magic wand question, which doesn't take budget or anything else into account. So take that for what it's worth. I did want to talk. I know that you also think about these big issues related to healthcare that are facing all of our healthcare programs. I'm wondering about your thoughts on health equity, and if you have, I'm sure you have given thought to what CMS could do or what providers can do to achieve the goal of advancing health equity. But do you have specific thoughts about how health equity can be advanced specifically through value-based payment models?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, I think there are a lot of strategies that could help to influence this. What exactly is the perfect one is unknown, and maybe there isn't a perfect model, but we just work to continue to improve from one year to the next, learning from what the program, how the program functioned in the past. Of course, the impact to those who are implementing and managing that program is something to be considered. CMS has a lot of purchasing power, as we are aware, and there have been a lot of discussions about how they can use that, whether it's with prescription drugs or, you know, other areas that they could have large influence. And so I think whether it's through actual policy or it's some smaller initiative or model that's experimented with that demonstrates solid outcomes and that's replicated by private industry or other, I think the sheer size and weight of CMS by itself stands and gives them the ability to create change here. In terms of, you know, I don't think there's an easy solution, but I think there is a solution out there. And if we can sort of combine the thoughts of all of the relevant stakeholders for advocacy agencies, for our healthcare system, policymakers themselves, I think we can definitely come up with the right solution as a starting point and then build upon it. I don't want to be so prescriptive or to state specifically what CMS should do around this, but only to say that I think that they have some ability to create change within this area.
I couldn't agree more. I know you talked about purchasing power. There's also just reach, right? How many tens of thousands of Medicare beneficiaries plus Medicaid beneficiaries are there out there? All of which CMS is reaching in one way or another. And we've talked about the number of models that CMS has run in the past, or CMMI has run in the past and is running now. And I just wonder what it would look like to have models that are specifically addressed towards particular groups or disease states that affect particular groups. It just seems like there is a lot of power there that could be directed towards addressing these issues, as well as developing data that could be used to target resources and make sure that these very stubborn health equity questions, that we make some progress there. I think they have a lot of opportunity, and I know they're taking it very seriously. So we'll see, eagerly wait and see how that develops over the next couple of years. Just to bring it a little bit closer to home, can you tell us a little bit more about what Caravan has planned for our partners, for service delivery in 2022?
Yeah, you know, our focus continues to be on our clients' success. And I think at the heart of that is to continue to improve quality and patient outcomes, to promote and succeed within the ACO model, and to provide the tools and technology and level of expertise that will drive success through the proven methods that we have. You know, I'm really excited about 2022 because we're finding ways to ensure that our clients continue to succeed and to address the key issues and challenges that they're faced with. So looking forward to 2022, I think our clients will benefit more from the new and expanded regional support and population health expertise that we'll be providing. We'll be finding ways to increase and the speed at which data is provided. We'll be introducing new tools around disease management programs, performance dashboards and opportunity analyses, revamping our face sheets. There's a lot of exciting work to come, and I'm very encouraged by the work of our teams internally, but also the amazing work that our clients have done to improve the care that they provide to patients at the national level. And I think we'll continue to get even better, just given our emphasis on process improvement. And
so just to wrap up here, what are you looking forward to most this year for the company?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in general, just Eclipse in 2021, I think there'll always be new challenges, and I'm looking forward to helping our clients navigate what's to come, the knowns and the unexpected. I think as a company, we continue to find new ways to get better and to improve despite the successes of the prior year. And I think 2022 will be no different.
Thank you. So Miguel, it's been a pleasure having you here on Healthcare by the Numbers. Are there any final thoughts or comments you want to leave us with?
Well, Louise, thanks for having me again. It's been a pleasure. And you've asked some really thoughtful questions. And I hope that my commentary has been helpful to you and your audience. Happy 2022 to you and to everyone out there. Thanks for having me again.
Appreciate it. And thank you for joining us today. For our audience, if you'd like to learn more about Miguel Brumont and the work he is doing at Caravan Health, you can find him at LinkedIn, and more information is available at www.caravanhealth.com. Thank you so much for listening today. We are Caravan Health, and this has been Healthcare by the Numbers. Until next time, take care.